I think we can start. So today we have the pleasure of having Fernando Barbero talking about separability and quantum mechanics. So Fernando, please go ahead.
Okay, thank you. So the title of the talk is Separability and Quantum Mechanics. Some of the things that I will be talking about here appeared in a paper that I wrote together with Eduardo Sánchez Villaseñor and Jorge Prieto. So please go to slide number 2. This is a summary of the talk. I will just refresh some basic concepts on separability. Then I will say some things about separable and non-separable Hilbert spaces. And then I will go to the problem of studying the role of separability in quantum mechanics, although I will say some things first regarding separability in quantum field theory. In this section, I will discuss non-equivalent representations of the canonical commutation relations in quantum mechanics. Then I will go to polymer quantum mechanics. Some of the things that I will be talking about are well known by most of the people, but I will concentrate on a specific example, which is the study of the energy spectrum of some of these models. In particular, I will look at the polymerized harmonic oscillator. Okay. And one of the reasons I want to do that is because I want to discuss the role of non-separability in the statistical mechanics. And then I will end the talk with some comments, and I will mention some things that may be relevant for loop quantum gravity and loop quantum cosmology. But the main purpose of the talk, as I say at the bottom of this slide, is to discuss the physical role of separability in quantum field theory and quantum mechanics, and then try to see if one can conceivably use non-separable physical Hilbert spaces in physics. So please go to slide number 3. Separability is a topological concept. So you have a topological space. We say that it is separable if it has a dense countable subset. Of course, as it usually happens in mathematics, it's useful to have other characterizations. So some of them appear there. For example, it's possible to see that topological space is separable if you can find a countable subset such that its closure is equal to the total space. Now, for second countable spaces, which are those which have a countable basis for the topology, it's easy to see that they are always separable. The argument is just a two-line reasoning. Suppose that you have a basis for the topology, all the elements of the basis Zn, and now you pick an element in each of these open sets in the basis. And now consider the set Y, which is the union of all the singletons, sets in which you have just one of these sets. Now, of course, this is obviously countable. See that it tends just pick any point in X in the total space. If you take a neighborhood of this point, an open neighborhood, then, of course, it can be written as the union of some of the Vs, of the Vns. Each of these has an element of X, then the intersection of this open neighborhood with Y, it will be non-empty, okay? If you are in measurable spaces, then separability is really equivalent to the second countability that I mentioned before. Simple examples of separable and non-separable spaces, of course, if you have a finite topological space, it will be separable. If you take, for example, the real line with the usual topology, then you can easily come up with a countable set which is closed, for example, the rational numbers, as I write there. If you have any set and you have the trivial topology, which is the one that has only the empty set and the total space, then every set which is not empty has a property that the closure is the total space. So it will be separable. For example, the continuous functions on a closed interval with the metric topology defined by the distance given by the least upper bound is separable. For example, a countable separable dense set is just the one given by polynomials with rational coefficients. And a simple example also of non-separable space. Suppose that you take an uncountable set X, then that will not, in the discrete topology, then that will not be separable because every proper subset is closed. Then, for example, every countable subset will be a proper subset of X, and as the closure will coincide with the subset, will never be the full, the total space. So by using the first characterization that I introduced before, it's easy to see that such an X will not be separable. Now, separability and hidden spaces, please go to slide number 4. Hidden spaces are examples of topological spaces, which a basis that can be built from balls, from open balls, as they write there in this slide. There is a useful characterization of separable Hilbert spaces. A Hilbert space is separable if and only if it has a countable complete orthonormal set. And remember that a set, which may be countable or not, is an orthonormal basis if the vectors are orthogonal to each other, if they are normalized to 1, and if the closure of the linear span of the set is the full Hilbert space. Now, comments on this. All infinite dimensional separable complex Hilbert spaces are isometrically isomorphic to small L2 of N, which is just a space of sequences of complex numbers satisfying the condition that the sum of the absolute values squared of the elements of the sequence is finite. Countable direct sums of separable Hilbert spaces are separable, and in particular, focus spaces, which are the ones that that we use in standard perturbative quantum field theory, which are built from separable one-particle Hilbert spaces, are separable. Let's go to slide number 5. Now, before I start discussing separability and quantum mechanics, I will say some things about separability and quantum field theory. One could naively expect, as I say there, that if you are in quantum field theory, if you are working, you are trying to quantize a system of fields, you will somehow need a bigger Hilbert space. But then when you look up what people do in traditional axiomatic approaches to quantum field theory, for example, if you look at the Weidmann axioms, they always rely on separable Hilbert spaces. In fact, if, for example, you look up this famous book of Stricker and Weidmann, PCT, spin and statistics, and all that, you can read statements such as the one that they're writing there. All, after some arguments, they say that all these arguments make it clear that there is no evidence that separable Hilbert spaces are not the natural state spaces for quantum field theory. Of course, they even have loop quantum gravity in mind, but this is what people work, even those people who are working in more formal axiomatic approaches to quantum field theory. Now, there are physical models, toy models, where you may actually believe that tensor products of countably many separable Hilbert spaces may play a role. For example, if you try to quantize an infinite chain of qubits. But even in that case, even though it is true that you can introduce the notion of a countable tensor product of Hilbert spaces, it's actually not necessary. This is also mentioned by Stricker and Weidmann in the book that I mentioned before. And if you study the book on quantum field theory in Kerber spacetimes by Wall, then you will find a similar statement there. So please go to slide number 6. The reason why Stricker and Weidmann said that this is not necessary is written there. Thus, while it may be a matter of convenience to regard that state space and a countable tensor product of Hilbert spaces as part of an infinite tensor product, it is not really necessary. Okay? So I think it's fair to say that the most well-known and widespread application of non-separable Hilbert spaces is certainly within the realm of loop quantum gravity and loop quantum cosmology. So what about quantum...
Orlando, this is Abhay. Just a quick comment, which is, and you know this, but for the rest of the people, I think it was Walter Turing and somebody else had written this very nice paper showing that you could do the quantization of the Maxwell field without introducing indefinite metrics or violating Lorentz covariance if you used non-separable Hilbert spaces at the kinematical level. In other words, before you introduce the Gauss constraint. So there is at least one example which was kind of
I think technically it probably came after loop quantum gravity, but I don't think he was motivated from the loop quantum gravity. He was just motivated from Maxwell's quantum field theory by itself.
Yeah, thank you for your comment, because I think it's good to have the idea in mind that one of the reasons why people started looking at these things was because we were doing loop quantum gravity in non-separable Hilbert spaces, so it really makes sense to see what you can do with this kind of non-separable spaces in more familiar contexts, of course. Yes. Okay, so let's go ahead. So what about quantum mechanics? So let's go to slide number 7. Now, separability appears explicitly in the postulates of quantum mechanics. So if you look, for example, in this very influential book by von Neumann, The Mathematical Foundations of Quantum Mechanics, it's written there. So it's clear, and if you look up the postulates of quantum mechanics, then it's clearly stated at the beginning that you will consider only separable physical spaces. And I think it's fair to say that there are not many reasons to renounce these assumptions in that setting. But it is also true that from a foundational or philosophical or interpretational point of view, it's interesting to see what happens if we drop it, okay? So we'll say something about that in a minute. If you look at the bibliography, then you find that mathematicians, in particular people doing functional analysis, have actually studied the Schrödinger equation in non-separable Hilbert spaces since the 60s, actually. For example, the oldest paper that we had been able to find is written by someone whose name is Bernat, and then we found some other papers. In particular, there's a bunch of them by a Polish functional analyst, Wojnarowski, that I will mention in the following. So mathematicians have really looked at these problems in simple settings, and in fact, I will rely on some results that are due to these people. Now, around 2000 or 2001, there is a paper by a philosopher or mathematician, Halvorsen, who discussed the Bohr complementarity principle from this perspective. Let me remind you that the Bohr complementarity principle says that a particle can never have both a sharp position and a sharp momentum. And then from a philosophical point of view or interpretational point of view, it's interesting to see how this principle can be understood from the perspective of the existence of representations of the canonical commutational relations. So as I will show you in a minute, it is actually possible to introduce a framework where particles can either have precise positions or precise momenta in a very dramatic way, which most of you know, which consists of the fact that you either have positions or you have no momentum operators, or vice versa. So please go to slide number 8. The key idea is to just circumvent the conclusions of the Stone-Von-Neumann theorem, which tell us something about the uniqueness of the Schrödinger representation for the canonical commutation relations in wild form, by relaxing the separability hypothesis of the representation of Hilbert space. And in fact, once you do this, you can build concrete representations. In fact, an infinite number of non-equivalent, non-unitary equivalent representations of these biocanonical commutation relations, which have this feature that I mentioned before. They're capable of allowing a state with precise position. That means eigenstate of the position of an operator, which are normalizable and with an eigenvalue, or momentum value. Okay? Now, there are some physical issues that one should keep in mind. For example, one should really address the measurement problem because, of course, once you are doing a real measurement, then finite experimental resolution means that it is, in fact, impossible to ascertain that you have an absolutely sharp position. Okay, but I should also add that we don't have such problems with energy measurements. So we are used to having the idea that you have an atom, for example, an atomic system, there you have precise values of the energy, okay? So in some sense, what one can see is that one can find representations by dropping the separability hypothesis where the positions have, or the momenta have, sharp values, okay? And now, of course, let me just mention here that this loss of uniqueness of the representations of the quantum commutation relations is familiar in the framework of a standard quantum field theory with different consequences, or usually we exploit it in a different way, but that is a phenomenon that it is present also there, okay? So please go to slide number 9. Now, let me just tell you what how to build concrete representations of this by algebra. A very useful, complex, non-separable Hilbert space where you can build these representations easily is this space that I am calling here small L2 of R, which is just a set of functions from the complex functions on the real line, such that that continuous sum, the sum of the absolute square of the values of the functions, is finite. The scalar product is defined in the usual way, but the sum is a continuous sum. And of course, every time I write a continuous sum, in this case a sum that extends over the whole real line, then in order for these things to make sense, the set where the value of the function psi is different from zero must be at most countable. It can be finite or countable. Otherwise, it makes no sense to talk about this infinite sum. Now, there's a basic result, which appears, for example, in a paper by Halvorsson that I will mention at the end of the talk in the bibliography, which has the following. The Weyl algebra that I am writing down there for two families of one-parameter families of operators, U and V, admits unitarily equivalent irreducible representations in this space. In fact, it is known that there is an infinite number of inequivalent representations. How do they look like? So please go to slide number 10. Now, I will start describing the position representation, and then I will talk about the momentum representation. But before I do that, there is something important to keep in mind here, which is the following thing. When we are doing standard quantum mechanics in a separable Hilbert space, then we all know, as a consequence of the Stone von Neumann theorem, that all the representations of the canonical commutation relations are unitarily equivalent. So when we talk about position representation or momentum representation in the standard quantum mechanics, these are equivalent representations that are connected by a unitary transformation that is usually implemented by the Fourier transform. Okay? Here in this setting, I will talk about position representation or momentum representation, but these will not be unitarily equivalent. These are inequivalent representations. And then when I discuss the particular case of the polymerized harmonic oscillator, I will choose one of these, for example, the position representation, and then I will study it in some other Hilbert spaces, and I will give you some other representations which will be unitarily equivalent to this one, okay? So it's slightly different from the standard thing where position representation and momentum representation are really unitarily equivalent, okay? So let me now describe how these representations will look like. For example, the position representation on a small L2 of R is provided by these two families of one-parameter families of operators, U, P, and V, Q, which are defined like that, where delta Q0 is a function defined on the real line with a support just on the point Q0. It's zero everywhere with the section of the point Q0 where it has value 1, okay? And then you define it like that. It's easy to see that, for example, V is not weakly continuous. You just consider a scalar product, and you see that with arbitrary states, and you see that it is not weakly continuous, and then there is no momentum operator. So it's, as I was saying before, the situation where you cannot really talk about momenta at all. For example, you cannot even think of the uncertainty relations in this setting because there is no way you can make sense of just uncertainty in momenta. But then the one-parameter family U, that is weakly continuous, so there is a position operator, which is self-adjoint and unbounded, which is defined as I showed you there. It's just proportional to the derivative U at zero, and it satisfies that these delta Qs are actual eigenvectors. So you have these are normalizable states in this Hilbert space, and then each of them has eigenvalue Q. in the domain which is the one that I am writing there. Of course, you need the, these are not bundled operators, so the domain is not the full Hilbert space, but just a denser set of it, okay? Now, the momentum representation, and of course, once you have these operators, you can check, it's a very simple computation, that the Weyl computation relations that I wrote in the previous slide are satisfied. It's very easy. Now, the momentum representation works very much in the same way. That is the definition of the one-parameter family of operators U and V. Now, in this case, U is not weakly continuous, so there is no position operator. And V is weakly continuous, then there is a momentum operator, which is, again, self-adjoint and unbounded, is defined in the usual way. Now, in this representation, I can have real eigenvalues or eigenvectors with sharp with eigenvalues for the momentum operator in a domain which is similar. It's essentially the same as the one that I described before in the position representation. So please go now to slide number 11. Now, actually, there is a theorem that appears also in this paper that I mentioned before by Halvorsen that proves in a very easy way that in any representation of the canonical commutation relations in Weyl form, if, say, Q exists and has an eigenvector, then P does not exist, or vice versa. Now, the proof is easy. Suppose that you have a representation of the Weyl algebra, and then you have a state which is an eigenvector for some of one of these one-parameter families of operators, say V, then it's a short computation to a short computation tells you that this equality that I'm writing there, E to I A B times the scalar product of phi and U A of phi, is equal to the scalar product of phi and U F on U A of phi. That means that the scalar product of phi and U A of phi is proportional to delta 0 A. So it will be 0 if A is different from 0, and it will be a constant if A is equal to 0. So you can see that then the function that maps the real parameter A to UA is discontinuous. And then you will not have the corresponding generator. Okay? Now, several comments. These representations are built in this small L square of R that have no analog in small L square of N. So from that sense, one can see that what the difference is between separable Hilbert spaces and some non-separable Hilbert spaces. This has been found several times independently, so that is something that I must say. So for example, if you read the paper by Ashtekov, Hurst, and Willis, the references at the end of the talk, then of course you find these representations there. They're quite natural, I must say. And probably these were also discovered before the paper by Halvorsen, by some of these functional analysts that I mentioned at the beginning. Now, the non-existence of either momentum or position operators makes it very difficult to be observables of physical interest. For example, Hamiltonians, and of course, you all know that all this business of polymerization is really a way to really avoid this difficulty, okay? So this is well-known within the community, in particular by the people who work in loop quantum cosmology. Let's go now to slide number 12. I will concentrate now on polymer quantum mechanics. So we'll study a simple application, which is the polymeric harmonic oscillator. This has been looked at by many people, and there is a lot of information that is written in papers, but there are some questions that I want to discuss that I think are important, in particular when you have in mind physical applications, for example, statistical mechanics. Now, the polymeric harmonic oscillator is really a nice play model for loop quantum cosmology and to a lesser extent to loop quantum gravity. And it really helps you understand the role of non-separability, okay? So there is a bunch of questions that one would like to answer. For example, to what extent this is really similar to the harmonic oscillator? As I will mention in the following, there are some similarities, but there are some crucial differences, okay? Another question is, to what extent we recover the standard energy levels of the harmonic oscillator in some limit? We'll show you that, well, this is not completely true. There is an important issue which has to do with the degeneracies. I will say some things about that. And then again, I will show you that some of the problem of the degeneracy is in particular very important for the statistical mechanical considerations, and in my opinion, in the long run, also for physical applications. Now, there is a very important comment that I want to make at this stage, which is the following. If you introduce a non-separable Hilbert space to quantize the harmonic oscillator, then you realize that the spectrum of the Hamiltonian, whatever Hamiltonian you're writing there, cannot be both pure point and countable, because if you have just a countable set of eigenvectors, then you will not have an orthonormal basis for the non-separable Hilbert space that you're using for your quantization. So you really expect to have many, many more states. You should find an orthonormal basis of eigenspaces of the Hamiltonian, which is not countable. Okay? So please go now to slide number 15. Now, there are several Hilbert spaces which are useful in order to study the polymerized harmonic oscillator. This I mentioned before. I will choose one of these non-unitary equivalent representations that I mentioned at the beginning, say the position representation. But then I will study the problem of looking at the Hamiltonian or the harmonic oscillator in some other Hilbert spaces that are unitary equivalent to that. Okay? In particular, there are two of them which appear in the literature and are very useful. One is the Bohr compactification of the real line. It's L2 of the Bohr compactification BR with a measure which is the hard measure of the group, the Abelian group that you have there. Another one, which is also very useful and actually gives you a very somewhat intuitive the idea of what's going on here, is the Hilbert space of almost periodic functions or Besicovic functions on the real line. Okay, both of them are unitarily isomorphic to small L square of R. For example, the Hilbert space of almost periodic functions can be defined as I showed there. These are almost periodic functions. These are countable combinations, linear combinations, let me say like that, of exponentials e to I lambda x multiplied by some complex coefficients, where these lambdas can be any real number, and satisfying the restriction that the sum, now it's a countable sum of the squared absolute value of the n's, are finite. Okay, the scalar product is interesting. It's an average on the real line, so you are taking the limit when t goes to infinity of 1 over 2t, the integral between minus t and t of psi 1 complex conjugate times psi 2. This is interesting because, for example, if you have some function which is bounded, it's almost periodic and it's bounded, then, of course, that average will be finite. This is crucial because, as I will show you in a minute, solutions to the Schrödinger equation that in the standard representation of quantum mechanics in capital L2 of R are not really elements of the Hilbert space because they just behave as plane waves. In a setting such as this one, with this kind of a scalar product, are indeed normalized. Okay? Now, there is a bunch of linear isomorphisms between these Hilbert spaces, for example, the Fourier Bohr transforms and the inverse. And the inverses, and both the position and the momentum representations, as I said before, can really be implemented in these spaces, either the Bohr compactification of the real line, the L2 of the Bohr compactification of the real line, or the space of almost periodic functions. So it's a type of it should be AP. Okay? Now, for example, if you use a capital L2 of the Bohr compactification as the carrier of the position representation, and you see how the you have to basically do some kind of Fourier transform, then you see that the position operator is actually a derivative operator, and its minus square is the Laplacian. So in this sense, it's a little bit awkward, because when you do standard quantum mechanics, the position, the square of the momentum is different. the minus adoption. But it's very similar, of course. Many of these things appear, for example, in the paper by Hoymaski that I mentioned in the end, and there is a paper that I mentioned at the beginning that I wrote with Eduardo Villaseñor and Jorge Prieto, where you have a whole bunch of references where you can find all these things. So please go now to slide number 14. Now, suppose I want to discuss now how you build Hamiltonians in these spaces. Now, suppose that you have a real function on the real line, which is periodic piecewise continuous in the standard topology of the real line. Then this function defines, in the algebra of almost periodic functions, a boundary operator, which is a potential, say, for example, in the space of almost periodic functions on the real line. And now you can build a Hamiltonian, which is minus the Laplacian that I mentioned before, plus this potential, which is self-adjoint and unbounded in an appropriate domain. Now, there is a crucial result that you can use to obtain the spectrum of such a Hamiltonian and characterize it completely. And this result is the following. H, this Hamiltonian, has a pure point-point spectrum that coincides with the spectrum of the same operator with a periodic potential if you just take it as an operator in the standard capital L2 of R with the Lebesgue measure. Okay, so what this is telling you is the following very simple result. If you want to study this type of Hamiltonian that we are considering here for polymerized quantum systems, then what you have to do is just write the operator and pretend that you are working on the standard Hilbert space of quantum mechanics, quantum mechanics, get the spectrum there, and then just change one thing, which is the fact that whereas the points that you will find there the spectrum that you will find in the standard setting is a continuous spectrum, and this is written there. This is the result of the Bloch theorem, which we will study in undergraduate courses. Then all the points of that spectrum actually correspond to real eigenvalues of the Hamiltonian in the non-separable Hilbert space that we are working with here. So this tells you that the spectrum of these operators consists of bands, the same type of bands that you find for periodic potentials in standard quantum mechanics, okay? Now, if you write explicitly the eigenvalue equations, then, of course, they look very differently in all these different Hilbert spaces, in particular in L2 and, for example, in the Hilbert space of almost periodic functions. So please go now to slide number 15. Now let's just to give a concrete example, let's go to the harmonic oscillator. The classical Hamiltonian for the harmonic oscillator is written there. Now, in this position representation or momentum representations that I'm considering here in non-separable spaces, you can write the Hamiltonian as it is written here. Then actually what you do is, in each of these cases, you introduce a length scale that you need. And then in terms of these parameters that I'm calling either Q0 when I'm working with the position representation of P0 that I'm introducing the momentum representation, you can pick any of these two Hamiltonians. They will have different spectra, but you can actually make a choice for P0 and Q0 in such a way that the spectra coincide. So this is a simple way of, this is of course the standard thing, of introducing a Hamiltonian operator in these spaces that somehow mimics the classical Hamiltonian of the harmonic oscillator. Now, this is also well known. The eigenvalue equation in small L square in the potential representation is written there. It is a difference equation, and of course there are some restrictions on the domain on the operators, so the eigenfunction psi must satisfy these two conditions that I'm writing there. Alternatively, if you perform a Fourier-Born transform, you can write the eigenvalue equation, say, in the L2 of the Bohr quantification of the real line or the space of the Hilbert space of almost periodic functions, and then you will find a second-order differential equation which can be actually written as the Mathieu equation that I am writing down at the bottom of this slide. So please go now to slide number 17. Of course, there is, well, as I'm saying, then, of course, that this is actually the simplest way of writing this operator, but it's very important to realize that there is a huge ambiguity here. This is known within the community. It was explicitly mentioned by, among some other people, Corici, Bukashinak, and Zapata. And in fact, what you see is that if you, for example, are working in the position representation of LTBR, then you can actually use any periodic function, in some sense, depending on one parameter, that has a property that in an appropriate limit, it looks like p squared, something proportional to p squared pointwise, as I am writing here. And in fact, instead of working with sine and cosines, which give you this Mathieu equation, which is somewhat complicated, you can actually make a choice which will give you something which is very, very simple. Just take a standard potential, something which is proportional to p squared, restrict it to some even interval of the real line, and then extend it by periodicity, and consider the problem, the Hamiltonian, that potential, which is a periodic potential, and consider the problem there. So if you do that, it's really a very simple exercise to compute the band spectrum by using the standard procedure. And then what you will see is shown in slide number 18. So let me just pause here and tell you what this means. So what I am representing here in red is this quadratic potential restricted to some segment of the real line. The full potential that we have to consider is the periodic extension of that, okay? So the Hamiltonian is written at the top of the transparency. It will be minus the Laplacian plus this periodic extension of the quadratic potential. I have chosen, in this particular plot, we have chosen the, all the constants in such a way that actually it corresponds to the segment minus 4 plus 4. Now, you can compute the bands by getting something which is called the transfer matrix and a standard way to look for the position of the edges of the bands is finding the values of the energy that satisfy the condition that the choice of this transfer matrix is either plus 2 or minus 2. So that is all that appears also in the plot. Then you see the green vertical lines correspond to plus 2 or minus 2. There is a curve which is in dark blue that is actually the trace of the of this transfer matrix. And if you look at the top of the plot, then you will see that this blue curve cuts the two vertical green lines in some points that define the edges of the band. If you look at the bottom of the plot, what happens is that this blue curve is almost, the graph is almost parallel to the x-axis, so actually you see some dark line which is really superimposed to the band, okay? There are some other things that one can see here. For example, with these particular choices of parameters for this potential, you see that the first but there are some things that look very much like the levels, the energy levels of the harmonic oscillator. If you look at the first four, five, even six bands, you see that the spacing between them is really very similar to each other, that the spacing from the bottom of the plot to the first one is just half of the difference between the next values. But one should keep it in mind that these are not just sharp eigenvalues. These are all of them bands which are very narrow but have an infinite number of eigenstates of the energy. So you really have, you don't have isolated points in the energy spectrum, but you have bands, okay? Now, if you look at the top of the plot, then you see that the situation reverses quickly. Once you go above the maximum of the potential, then you see that you're getting wider and wider bands, and actually the gaps between them become very, very narrow. It's actually possible in this particular example to give the asymptotic behavior of this gap in terms of the number, an integer label that numbers the band, and you can see that these gaps go to zero very, very fast. So in practice, if you go to high energies, what you see is a continuum, just with some very, very small gaps that actually you cannot even plot if you go to higher energies, okay? So this is really, in this particular example, how the spectrum or the Hamiltonian looks like for one of these polymerized models, okay? So please go to slide number... Yes?
18, slide number 18. So I didn't understand the potential. So is the potential zero outside that interval?
No. It's a periodic extension of this potential. So you have just to take this plot and periodically continue it to the right and to the left. It's a periodic potential.
Okay. So this is your, I mean, by definition, you're calling this the polymer harmonic oscillator. Because you could also say polymer harmonic oscillator is the one which has a usual potential, right? Not periodic at all.
But in order to work in these polymerized Hilbert spaces, I need a periodic function. Otherwise, I don't know what to do, okay? So when you polymerize, for example, in the standard, when you get the Mathieu equation, you also have a periodic potential, which is 1 minus cosine, okay? So here, I am just taking advantage of these arbitrariness that Corici and Zapata and Bukasinac detected, and then I'm using another periodic potential instead of 1 minus cosine of x, which is just the periodic extension of this purely quadratic thing. Because in practice, it's easier to do computations. And, of course, qualitatively, the spectrum that you get is exactly the same, has exactly the same features that you would get instead of working with this potential, you just work with the Mathieu equation and the 1 minus cosine potential. Is that clear now?
Yeah, thank you.
Okay. Okay, so let's go now to slide number 19. So, again, it's Van der spectrum, okay? This is one of the main results of the talk. And again, the points in the bands, all the points in the bands are actual eigenvalues. Each one of them is associated with a normalizable state. Now, it's easy to see why these are normalizable states, because if you have in mind Bloch's theorem and you look how the states that you get when you study periodic potential in standard quantum mechanics look like, these states are the product of an exponential, say e to I some parameter times x, multiply by a periodic function of x. And then in the standard case, those things are not normalizable, basically because they don't fall off to zero. But now if you look at these from the perspective of the almost periodic functions, and you take the scalar product that you have in there, which is an average, as I was describing before, of course it's perfectly natural that these things have a finite norm, because these are bounded functions, and you can all those integrals make sense, give you a number. Okay, so the point of view is that if you take periodic potentials, then you can work in the standard setting, and then you just switch the scalar product to the usual one, to this one in the almost periodic case, and then you see that it is natural that all these functions are actual eigenfunctions of the Hamiltonian. Okay. It is important also to see that, of course, when you look at the Mathieu equation and you consider, for example, periodic solutions, then you can see that if you look at the lowest eigenvalues, you can justify that, well, they look similar to, say, m plus 1/2 of h bar omega. So one can, in some sense, say that, well, they are similar to the standard ones, but if you don't have in mind this band structure, then you need something which is crucial, which is that these things that in the plot that I showed before really look like energy levels actually consist of an infinite number of states. So somehow there is an infinite degeneracy if you go to the limit. Okay. Now, we believe that this is important from the physical point of view, in particular if you want to do statistical mechanics. And what I will describe in the next two transparencies, just to finish the talk, is, well, what happens if you try to do, for example, statistical mechanics, define the microcanonical or the canonical ensemble in this case. And my impression is that you really get into trouble. You also have to keep this thing in mind if you want, for example, to do a full quantization of the polymerized schema field. So I think that this may be relevant in different settings. But let me concentrate on the statistical mechanics thing. So please, let's go now to slide number 20. Now, the statement is that neither the microcanonical nor the canonical ensembles are well defined. And the reason is actually very simple. Suppose that you want to compute the statistical entropy, you work in the macrocanonical ensemble for a system as a function of energy. Then suppose that I tell you that the energy is E, what you have to do to compute the statistical entropy is just to count the number of eigenvalues of the Hamiltonian. But of course, if you have bands and you have an uncountable infinity of states of the energy, then of course you will get infinity. Okay, so when you compute, you can formalize this thing as the trace of a sum of some projector operators on the eigenspaces of energy E, but this sum is a continuous sum. And that makes no sense. I mean, you can also look at this as just some sum of degeneracies, which, by the way, these functional analysts have shown that cannot be greater than 2. But again, your sum is extended over a subset of the real lines, which is uncountable. So it's ill-defined, okay? Now, if you, instead of considering the microcanonical ensemble, you try to go to the canonical ensemble, then you have to compute the partition function. It's the trace of some other operator, exponential of minus beta h, and you run into the same kind of problem. This is a continuous sum over the spectrum. The spectrum has an uncountable number of eigenvalues, then it makes no sense. So the partition function doesn't work. You cannot define a Fermat density matrix and so on. So you really have a problem if you insist of doing statistical mechanics even with this very simple one-dimensional polymerized system. So let's go to slide number 21. Of course, the situation is conceptually different from the one corresponding to the standard Hamiltonian. If you take a periodic potential in capital L2 of R with the standard Lebesgue measure, then of course you know that there you have a purely absolutely continuous spectrum. But then if you look at the Hamiltonian or the exponential of the Hamiltonian, E2 minus beta H, but these are trace class operators. So you can do something else to define the microcanonical entropy or the potential function, which is integrate some density of states per energy interval. So that is actually how you would treat such a system in standard quantum mechanics where you don't have eigenvalues but a continuous spectrum. Okay? So the statement is that even though superficially the polymerized system and just a particle moving a periodic potential look very similar, at least if you look at the spectrum, they look similar, there is a crucial difference, which is the one that I mentioned before. In this case, if you are doing standard quantum mechanics, there are no eigenvalues, so you can make sense of the microcanonical entropy of the partition function, as I'm showing here, which is, by the way, the standard way of dealing with these things. So let's go now to slide number 22. Now, I will finish here with some comments, and some very quick comments. The kinematical, let me say something that may be relevant for loop quantum gravity and loop quantum cosmology. The kinematic of Hilbert spaces that one original, that one uses in loop quantum gravity are non-separable. But the expectation is that the physical Hilbert spaces are separable. So all these problems that I mentioned here should not appear in loop quantum gravity. Okay? So this is just a warning in the direction of saying, look, if you want to do polymer quantum mechanics, that's okay. You may learn some things, but there are some things that you cannot go too far. If you try to do physics in these polymer Hilbert spaces, you may run into trouble. Of course, if you find a procedure that will eliminate most of these states, which make these sums ill-defined, then you are fine. For example, there is evidence, there is a nice paper, a couple of papers by Alok Lada and Madhavan, where they have studied very carefully the polymer quantization of the parameterized scalar field, and this expectation is really realized. So there you can see that even though you start with a non-separable Hilbert space, you find a separable physical Hilbert space, and then all these problems that I mentioned are not there. There are some... my understanding is that some people think that you can work with abstract graphs instead of the usual standard non-separable Hilbert spaces in quantum gravity, and of course, if you can just avoid non-separability from the beginning, then of course these problems that I have mentioned will not be there. Okay. Now, one of my conclusions is that I really find it difficult to understand how non-separable Hilbert spaces could be physical Hilbert spaces. So again, beware of these four models with non-separable Hilbert spaces. One of the ways that, for example, people in loop quantum cosmology use to avoid these difficulties is just by applying some supersolution rules. If they can be applied, then of course those are the solution to this problem of the proliferation of the states, and then you're safe. I have no problem with that. And finally, if one in some other instances, if you want to study this polymerized system, then you really need to find some kind of physical criteria to kill the states that to kill an infinite number of the states that are really causing trouble to you. So let me finish here. Just last, the last slide, number 23, I've got some references. The first paper is this paper by Halvorsen that you can read. There are some parts which are more philosophical, so they're harder to read. There's, of course, a paper by Ashtekar, Halvorsen, Willis. These papers by Corici. There is a bunch of papers by Hojnarski, for example, that appear in the bibliography of reference number 6. That is the paper that I mentioned before. And basically, I will finish here. Okay?
Okay, thank you for the talk. Now, questions?
So, Fernando, I agree with you, certainly, that, you know, that when we go to the physical Hilbert space, it becomes separable. I mean, in all the examples that were looked at, in loop quantum cosmology, that is what has happened.
Yes.
But I still not kind of fully appreciate your point of view on statistical mechanics. So, I agree with the technical statements that you had on your slides 21, I think, and 23, maybe. Yeah, 21 or 20.
Yeah, 20.
So, right. So, this just says, means that if you were to use separable Hilbert space, a non-separable Hilbert space, you cannot just use the ensembles. In other words, these operators, e to the minus beta h, is just not trace class, right?
Yes.
So therefore,
yes,
it's not a good density matrix. That's what one is saying. So
yes.
Then, usually, in something like, one might say that, well, that means that I should just try to find out some regularization procedure or something. Right? I'm not saying that this is a secondary remark. I'm not saying, advocating that we should use these Hilbert spaces all the time. But from the point of view of just pure mathematical physics, it seems to me that that's a possibility. And a similar thing with the microcanonical ensemble. The problem is arising because in microcanonical ensemble, of course, we choose a little interval, right?
When
we consider the density of states of, around E. But is it not correct that if I just use sharply energy eigenvalue E, now in normal quantum mechanics, one doesn't want to do that because it may not be an eigenvalue, eigenvector, or if it is an eigenvector, then maybe it is degenerate. But in this case, is it not the, this is now a question, in this case, could I not use kind of a sharp eigenvalue and try to construct a density matrix, a microcanonical ensemble?
Then what happens, for example, in this particular case is that you can prove that the degeneracies are just at most 2. So you will get, if you just take pick a sharp value of the energy, then you will get that the entropy is 2, so or 1. So
right.
I don't see how you would avoid that problem.
All right, I see. But this is, I see. So in this particular example, that's what happens. Okay, yeah, so I guess then the statement is really about, again, some kind of regularization. I'm not strongly advocating it, but I think that some mathematical physicists or mathematician might actually do that. I mean, one often regularizes, you know, such quantities. And the other small minor comment about references and such thing was that, I mean, for pedagogical reasons, you started in 2000 or something. But, you know, I mean, this polymer example, maybe it was not published anywhere, but has been used in loop quantum cosmology, loop quantum gravity literature since the 1990s, at least.
Yeah, I'm sure about that.
Right, because that is actually what motivated what we should do with the graphs and so on. I mean, it really predates the graphs. And the statement is that this is because this was something that was noticed by people like, you know, just people doing quantum mechanics. I mean, in Emch book, for example, there's a book by Gerard Emch, in which he explicitly talks about these representations quite early on. And as far as I know, although at the time we did not know it when we were doing loop quantum gravity in the 90s, there is also a paper by Buchholz and Friedenhagen, in which they used these non-separable Hilbert spaces to deal with the infrared problems in QED. So that might be also helpful to know.
Yeah, actually, the oldest paper that I found on this is a paper by, it's mentioned in slide number 7, by Burnat, which is written in the early 60s. And then, and probably some of the results are even older than that. So depends on the kind of bibliography that, that you look at, then you find very old instances of this kind of studies. And of course, I had no intention of really reviewing the bibliography, because there is a huge, I mean, there is a huge number of papers on quantum mechanics in the last century, so it's actually impossible probably to know. Yes, yes. I was just mentioning some papers where we found some of the results that we are using, in particular to understand this structure of the energy of this polymerized Hamiltonian for the harmonic oscillator. It's nothing more than that.
Yes? Right. Yeah, it was not for you. It was just for everybody else to know that this has been around for a while. That's all. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
Fernando?
Yes.
What happens if one, you haven't done it probably, but maybe you have some thoughts, if one introduces interactions? I mean, suppose I had a polymerized hydrogen atom interacting with photons. Would that cause problems with a super selection solution to the problem, for instance?
I have no idea. I have not thought of that. Okay. I'm sorry that I cannot really answer your question.
And what about if you consider a time-dependent harmonic oscillator? Have you looked at that, and if you can find super-selecting sectors, etc.?
Well, we have not looked at that, but that's definitely a very interesting problem, because if you have a time-dependent harmonic oscillator, then, of course, just writing down the evolution for that is much, much more complicated than in the standard harmonic oscillator. And then you don't have the spectrum of the Hamiltonian to help you write the evolution operator, but somehow this non-separability should show up in some way. So it's actually a very interesting problem that we have not looked at. But, I mean, there should be some very interesting things going on when you try to write the full evolution operator. Yes, you're right. And there may be, it may be even possible that there are some examples that you can actually solve exactly. So you can conceivably probably solve that. We have looked at the time-dependent harmonic oscillator a long time ago, but in a completely different framework. So I could not tell you how to extend those results. But it's a very interesting problem. So if someone wants to look at that, it would be very interested in knowing what happens, yes.
Okay, thank you. More questions?
I have a question, Fernando. This is Alejandro.
Yes.
If I look at your slide 17, where you give this discretization, this polymerization of the operator P in terms of this D of Q naught, where Q naught is this parameter that, if I understand correctly, is the analog of in loop quantum cosmology. This is what leads to these super selected sectors. So if I use the idea of super selection, what happens to the spectrum? What happens to this?
Well, very likely you will pick just one eigenvalue in each of the bands, and then you will end up with something which will not be exactly like the spectrum of the harmonic oscillator, but you'll have just standard energy levels. Maybe probably depending on how you do this super selection, the difference in energy between the levels will not be constant, but I wouldn't expect nothing. That is what I would expect. So it's just that would be something closer to the standard harmonic oscillator. You're welcome.
Other comments or questions for Fernando?
Fernando, this is Hal. I had a question about unitary inequivalence in field theory. So you mentioned that that we're familiar with the lack of uniqueness of the canonical commutation relations, but I'm curious if thinking about the separability issue has given you any more insight into that in standard quantum field theory.
No, I mean, I think that usually when you're in even the framework of Fock spaces, you have this huge indeterminacy that, for example, you have a Lorentz symmetry you break just by taking the standard Poincaré invariant vacuum. So in that setting, I think it's nothing. I mean, that is what you would do. And I don't think that this non-separability, and that is working with Fock spaces, which are separable. So I suppose that if, on top of that, you work with non-separable Hilbert spaces, then you will have an even more complicated situation. And I don't know if it will be so easy to select, say, something like a vacuum. So it will be definitely much more complicated.
Thanks.
You're welcome.
But just want to say for this last question that these infrared problems of QED often have been dealt with in the early days using separable, non-separable Hilbert spaces. I just wanted to say that. And so that is, but there are specific kind of non-separable Hilbert spaces. You know, they're basically uncountable copies of Fock spaces, if you like. And so in that case, there is a lot of control, because people can do explicit calculations in that particular case.
Thank you.
Is there any other question?
Yeah, I do have one question, which is that I think it is to make it tractable that both the Mathieu equation or what you have done appear, the potential was made periodic, right?
Yes.
But in some sense, I mean, one should really go back to the original equation on some slide that you must have for harmonic oscillator. Maybe earlier slide. No. So I think it is 15 probably, right?
Yes.
In which you sort of have the first equation, the position representation equation. That was not used so much, but it might be good to know what happens there, right? Because in some sense, there the potential is really Q squared, and not
yes.
Two. But it mathematically just not tractable, right? And that's what you're saying.
Well, I think it's tractable. If you just go, if you just go to the, you can write the eigenvalue equation in small L 2, and then you get the difference equation. And then, if you want to have a differential equation, you do the Fourier Bohr transform and get the Mathieu equation. So I think it's completely tractable. That's my understanding.
Yes, I got confused because, I'm sorry, I just forgotten various things here. So you're saying that, I'm asking a question about our own paper. If I go to slide 15 again with the first equation there, you're saying that even though the potential there is not periodic, right, Q squared is not periodic, somehow
In a sense, it is. I mean, when you do the Fourier bond transform, you will get something which is a periodic potential. That is why you get the Mathieu equation, right?
Yeah, that's why you get the Mathieu equation. Okay, thank you for reminding me. Thank you. Okay.
Well,
okay, if there are no more questions, let's thank Fernando again.
Thank you.